Today is Monday, January the 18th, and this is Kathy coming to you with the News Gazette, which actually goes on out on Sunday, so it's the Sunday edition. So starting with page one on the front page, University of Illinois study session. With knowledge from fall under their belt, U of I officials urge vigilance as students return for spring semester this week, by Ben Zichterman. When students arrived on campus in the fall, they brought with them more than 350 cases of COVID-19. Expect a bigger influx this semester, University of Illinois epidemiologist Rebecca Smith said. But new steps should prevent the even larger secondary spike that was seen in the fall. The primary spike will be larger than last semester because spread is higher across the country, she said. What we're doing to do our best is to avoid a large secondary spike from transmission among people who have returned. The first step to prevent that is urging students, many of whom will return to campus later this week, to stay in their dorm or apartment except for essential activities until they've received two negative tests at least 3 days apart. The second test should catch COVID-19 cases among people who were infected in the previous 3 days but didn't test positive on the first test. One test will tell you if you're infectious right now, but it doesn't tell us if you were infected in the last 3 days or so, Smith said. There's a little variability there, but most cases can't be detected in the first 1 to 3 days, so two tests 3 days apart should capture any infections from before returning to campus. The U of I has also learned lessons from last semester, when administrators blamed high case counts on students violating quarantine and isolation guidelines even after they tested positive. In response, the U of I created Shield Team 30, which aims to contact students who test positive within 30 minutes to instruct them on what to do. That really did make a huge difference, Smith said. The U of I also increased its party patrol enforcement, encouraged people to report violations, and reminded students of the discipline they could face. This past semester, over 2,700 students were reported for COVID violations, Dean of Students Stephen Bryan said last week in a COVID-19 briefing. And to date, 50 students have been dismissed and 11 organizations sanctioned. Some people who hosted house parties received more than $1,300 in fines, U of I Police Chief Alice Carey said. We saw that last semester. The vast majority of our campus community wants to do the right thing and protect each other, she said. But we do have that mechanism to enforce health codes in case we need it, and the fines for violations can be steep. With new, more contagious variant of COVID-19, which the U of I saliva-based tests can detect, making its way into the U.S., Smith said it's even more important for students to follow health guidelines. These variants, at least B.1.17, is more transmissible, so it requires a higher level of compliance, she said. We can get by with the level of compliance we had at the end of the semester, which wasn't ideal, but we could control clusters as they appeared. With the new variant, we're concerned that won't be the case. The U of I has also shifted to smaller tubes for its saliva tests, which is supposed to allow them to be processed with more automation, lead to fewer invalid or inconclusive results. That should help avoid some of the backlogs experienced early in the fall semester when results were taking nearly 2 days rather than a few hours. The lab capacity is increased, and they think they can handle an influx for a few days, though not in the long term, Smith said. They have some surge capacity. To prevent delays, the U of I pushed back the start of the semester by a week and is encouraging students to return early to get their two negative tests in before classes start on January 25th. But perhaps the biggest challenge will be fatigue. Spring break was canceled in an effort to prevent more spread as a result of travel, which has both students and administrators worried about burnout and wellness. Students will get 3 weekdays off through the semester, but the lack of a spring break is extremely detrimental, student senator and junior Dana Young said. That week is not only used for students and professors to decompress, but it's also used to catch up on things, she said. Yun is taking online classes to already more challenging than in-person classes. In person, it's a lot easier to stay focused and a lot easier to absorb more information, she said. I find myself having to watch lectures several times to fully absorb the information. While her professors have done a good job of staying online after virtual classes to answer questions and encouraging classmates to connect, she said it's more difficult than with in-person classes. Just meeting other students in class, not only for social purposes, but to study together and make study groups, Yun said. Through Zoom, it's a lot more difficult to meet other students and see how other students are reacting, behaving, and how they want to work together. As a student senator, she also said she's heard from other students who aren't connecting as well, whether that's because they have to watch the lectures in an inconvenient time zone, are having trouble finding a quiet place to study at home, or have a professor who doesn't take time to interact with their students. It's been difficult for a lot of students, Young said. At the briefing last week, administrators said they have stepped up their mental health offerings and said students in crisis would be able to get same-day appointments. Student Senator and sophomore Enoma Egyebor said she's excited to return to campus, but a bit anxious about coming back when COVID-19 is spreading so rapidly around the country. I'm happy the school has frequent testing, Egyebor said. And she doesn't mind making time to get tested twice a week, but said she thought the administration could provide an incentive for testing regularly, perhaps a gift card, rather than just threatening punishment for missing tests. Yes, we should be doing it anyway, Egyebor said. But with COVID, even worse now, there should be more incentives. Smith said the fatigue could be worse with the vaccine on the way. Something we've experienced with other diseases is that knowing there is a vaccine may make people feel they can relax because the end is coming, she said. But the vaccine is a long way off for most of our undergraduates. We have great news on the vaccine front, but until you've gotten both shots and had a couple weeks for the immune response to develop, it's not going to be helping you, Smith said. Chancellor Robert Jones said that while there's finally some light appearing at the end of this apparently never-ending tunnel, the end of the tunnel is still months away. We have to really be more vigilant than we were, perhaps in the fall, he said. We cannot afford to relax now. And the opinion column from Tom Kasich is also on the front page. Better times are ahead for Illinois Republicans. Here in East Central Illinois, the Republican Party looks like a badly split organization, with one fervently Trumpist member of Congress, one who has made a bitter break with the outgoing president, and another straddling the middle. In the rural 15th Congressional District that includes Rantoul, Danville, Tuscola, and much of southern Illinois, there is U.S. Representative Mary Miller, a freshman member so enamored with President Donald Trump that she carries a purse made to look like a can of Coke with the word Trump emblazoned on it. She was one of 147 House Republicans, but only two in Illinois, who voted in support of objections to the results of the 2020 presidential election, claiming that some states conducted their elections in an unconstitutional manner. And in the wake of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Miller told the Epoch Times, a right-wing newspaper, that despite the presence of rioters who carried Trump flags and banners and wore Trump memorabilia, she wasn't sure who was behind the assault. I think we shouldn't rush to conclusions. One side is saying it's Trump, another side saying it's Antifa, she said. Personally, I'm going to be slow to make a statement about that. I'm sure that it's under investigation. I wouldn't be surprised if it's both. The FBI said there was no evidence Antifa was involved in the siege. Instead, officials said rioters included members of the Proud Boys and white nationalist groups. Miller, who defeated her Democratic opponent in the November general election by nearly 47 percentage points, even better than Trump's 45.7% bulge in the district, is a good match for her bright red district. It is the most conservative district in Illinois, one of the most conservative in the Midwest, and hasn't supported a Democrat in more than a decade. Even widely admired Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White lost the district by 7 percentage points in 2018. Miller voted against impeaching Trump and said her allegiance isn't solely to the GOP. I'm committed to the conservative platform even more than the Republican Party, she said. Representing Champaign-Urbana and much of the state to the southwest is Republican Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville, recently elected to his fifth term. Davis has taken a middle course on Trump, voting against overturning the election results and against impeachment. Davis, who won the 13th Congressional District by 9 percentage points and outperformed Trump by more than 5 percentage points, said he voted against impeachment because the process was rushed with no hearings, no evidence presented, and no time for thoughtful deliberation. Trump's punishment, Davis said, is he won't be president after Wednesday, and claims of a rigged election are false. He listened to people tell him that somehow he lost the election due to fraud, and that clown car legal team that he had was 0-for-60 in the court of law in presenting what they said in press conferences were complete facts, but which were in the end completely bungled legal cases. Davis, a frequent guest on radio and television outside of his district, said on Chicago radio station WGN. Still, Davis voted with Trump almost 89% of the time and endorsed him for re-election in 2020, after rescinding his endorsement in 2016. Just north of Champaign-Urbana is the 16th congressional district, represented by Representative Adam Kinzinger, Chanahan. It extends from Gibson City to the Wisconsin state line. A six-term congressman, Kinzinger, like Davis, is a potential candidate for statewide office in 2022. But Kinzinger angered some of his conservative district. Trump won it in November by nearly 16 percentage points by voting against the election challenge and for Trump's impeachment. Kinzinger won the district by almost 30 percentage points, and he minced no words talking about the outgoing president. "I think the president, for all intents and purposes, is not the president. He's just nuts. He's going crazy," Kinzinger told CBS News. It's moderate Republicans like Kinzinger, willing to make a quick and clean break with Trump, who are the future of the state Republican Party. Trump's loss, finally, is good news for the Illinois GOP, although he won six of the state's 18 congressional districts by between 1.7 and 45.7 percentage points. He lost the other 12 by anywhere from 2.5 to 74 percentage points. Overall, he lost the state by a stunning 17 percentage points, twice. Trump will no longer be a handicap to Republicans in the Chicago suburbs and in places like Champaign County, where he could manage no more than 37% of the vote, and where the once dominant GOP lost six countywide officers since Trump became president. Democrats also gained a pair of seats in both the Illinois House and Senate since 2016. Trump's loss, combined with the demise of Michael J. Madigan, the longtime Speaker of the House, who has bedeviled Republicans in the legislature for 50 years, makes January 2021 one of the best months for the Illinois GOP in years. The political pendulum may finally be moving in favor of Republicans in the land of Lincoln. And this column, this is a Tom Kasich edit personal opinion column, which appears in Sundays in the News Gazette. And in Top of the Morning, something to get you going today. The first week of COVID-19 vaccinations at the iHotel and Conference Center was as rewarding for the staff as it was for the patients. "It made all the effort worth it," said Brian Bauer, associate director of the Illinois Fire Service Institute, who helped with coordination and implementation at the first-of-its-kind clinic. "To be able to help the most vulnerable people in our community and to see their reaction, a lot of them shared with us that it was their first time out of the house since the pandemic started." Last week, Champaign County residents 75 and older received the vaccine at the iHotel and Conference Center, site of one of two by-appointment clinics in Champaign. Many recipients and their families took to social media to share their happy visits, kind of like first-time parents from the hospital. Brower credited teamwork for what was a smooth, efficient process. "I told someone, if Henry Ford could walk in, he would say, 'I don't know if I could have done better.'" We'll chip in, too, this week as county residents 65 to 74 with underlying health conditions are vaccinated, making complimentary copies of the News Gazette available in waiting areas. Brower said the hope is to vaccinate up to 925 people a day as the pace continues to pick up. "It's the best experience I've had," said Brower, a first responder for 30 years. "All these different providers came together and pointed at the same center of the same target and said, 'This is our goal.'" And a little bit of history, area history. In 1921, the Champaign County Board of Supervisors was at the courthouse to take action on a request by the State Highway Commission to appropriate money for a right-of-way for a state highway east of Urbana. If approved, work on the pavement was expected to be underway by that summer. In 1971, a Mattoon High School cheerleader was injured when a rock was thrown through the window of the school's fan bus as it traveled west on Church Street after a basketball game at Champaign Central High School. In 2006, Linda Katehi was hired as head of the engineering college at Purdue University when the campus was in the midst of preparing a new strategic plan. She helped develop a plan to expand the engineering school by adding new faculty and increasing research funding, and oversaw a $500 million capital campaign. 2 weeks after she was hired, the September 11th hijacks happened. The lessons Katehi learned during those tough times would help her as she joined the University of Illinois and worked on its new strategic plan. She was to start April 1st as provost of the Urbana campus, its second highest administrator. And a little note from East Urbana: woman dies after being hit by car. An Urbana woman died Friday evening after being hit by a car earlier in the week at an intersection on the city's eastern edge. Champaign County Coroner Dwayne Northrup identified the woman as Tanya Barnett, 50. Urbana Police Lieutenant Dave Smizer said at 6:14 p.m. Wednesday, police were sent to the area of East Main and Dewey Streets for a report of a pedestrian having been hit by a car. Police learned that Mrs. Barnett was crossing Main from north to south near the bus stop about 50 feet west of the intersection with Dewey when she was hit. Smizer said Mrs. Barnett was not in the crosswalk. The sole occupant of the eastbound car, a 57-year-old Urbana woman, told police she had not seen Mrs. Barrett in the road. Mrs. Barnett. The driver was not ticketed. Mrs. Barnett was taken to Carle Foundation Hospital, where she died at 5:20 p.m. Friday from the injuries received in the accident. An inquest may be held later. Northrop's office and police department from Urbana, trained in crash investigations, continue to look into the incident. Anyone who may have seen what happened or has video from a nearby home or business is asked to share it with the Urbana Police by calling 384-2320. And some news from the Krannert Art Museum. It's called Inside Out by John Seidel. Making art in the midst of loss. Last year, Krannert Art Museum acquired Loss, an important painting by Kay Walking Stick, one of the most significant Native American artists active today. Loss has two parts, a turbulent waterfall at the right and abstract forms on the left. Its surface is unusually tactile, a result of mixing paint and wax together, and she primarily used her hands rather than brushes to apply the paint, in some parts scraping away to reveal colors underneath. Loss is part of a series Walking Stick created in response to the loss of her husband while she was teaching at Cornell University. The waterfall depicts one of the famous gorges of Ithaca, New York, and she developed the abstract forms as a reflection on Chief Joseph, the Nez Perce leader who resisted removal by the American government in the 1800s. For Walking Stick, the two sides represent a duality of the spiritual and the tangible, and she painted the abstract forms on a bulkier canvas which stands out several inches from the wall as a way to emphasize the greater and more lasting power of the spiritual. This powerful meditation on personal loss reminds us of the capacity of art to repair trauma and to heal our communities. The painting, one of the first works you will see in art since 1948, our installation of modern and contemporary art at CAM, also underscores our commitment to center Native voices and to present outstanding contemporary art by Indigenous artists, long neglected by the university, but now a focus of several units on campus, including American Indian Studies and Native American House and CAM. Privately raised funds allowed us to bring this work to Illinois. The John Needles Chester Endowment, established in the 1950s to beautify the U of I system campuses, and a much more recent endowment generously established for art acquisition by Richard and Roseanne Galvin Noel. And this column by Jay Simpson is called Jay's Take. Don't judge a book by its cover. At times growing up, people would tell me I needed to change the crowd I was around. I even heard it as a young adult. To make a long story short, I still surround myself with the same people. See, what many don't understand is that the people who they judge to be bad influences on me are usually the best influences and the best people to be around because they keep me humble and motivated. My friends would never allow me to indulge in anything that they know would jeopardize my career. They were the ones who encouraged me the most to stay focused in school and keep my grades up so I could make it out. Even though they were doing the complete opposite with their lives, they realized my gift and would literally fight me before letting me go down the same path. That's love, and it's exactly why I would never turn my back on them despite how anyone feels. Before you judge someone, get to know their story so you can understand why they act the way they do. They may have a heart of gold, but are just a product of their environment. Some of the greatest people have lived the most troubled lives, and going through those times made them who they are today. Get to know people for who they are internally before you pass judgment. I guarantee your opinion will change. It's all about the heart. And the most genuine people have been through the most. Spread love. And now another column by George Will, examining Trump's kinship with his critics. An autopsy of Donald Trump's presidency can proceed from an early example of his memorable utterances. On his 13th day in office, February 1, 2017, the first day of Black History Month, he said, "Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is getting recognized more and more, I notice." His word salad was interesting, not because it revealed pristine ignorance concerning the African-American leader, who died in 1895. Neither was it notable because of his ignorance about his ignorance. Rather, his statement about Douglas revealed, beyond his notorious laziness, forethought, preparation, unthinkable, his nonchalance about his ignorance. This gave him an immunity to embarrassment, an immunity that was the crucial ingredient of his political magnetism for scores of millions of Americans, mesmerized by the strange but undeniably charisma of Trump's serene obliviousness regarding reality. Clad in his armor of insufficient indifference about information, he displayed a jaunty disdain for facts that struck his supporters, not wrongly, as a rare kind of strength. It also made him more akin to many of his cultured despisers than he or they recognize. He began his political career spouting birtherism and concluded it, he will not be back. Like vaudeville, he is yesterday's entertainment, raving about an election-rigging conspiracy so vast that it involved legions in many states and so cunning that it left no evidence of itself. As Trump skittered across the surface of public life, many of his critics were too busy savoring their superiority to him to recognize their mental kinship with him. They consciously, and he by cultural osmosis, are participants in the postmodern rejection of reason. He and they are collaborators in the rising rejection of the Enlightenment that produced classic liberalism in this republic. Postmodernists say, with Nietzsche, that there are no facts, only interpretations, alternative narratives about reality. As Andrew Sullivan writes in Substack, to be woke is to be awake to this. All claims of disinterestedness, objectivity, and universality are bogus. So, reasoning is specious and attempts at persuasion are pointless. Hence, society is an arena of willfulness where all disagreements are power struggles among identity groups. The concept of the individual disappears as identity becomes fluid, deriving from group membership. Silence is violence. What is spoken is mandatory and must accord with the mentality of the listeners. Welcome to campus. In a world thus understood, life is a comprehensively zero-sum struggle. Postmodernism rejects, as Adam Garfinkel writes, the Enlightenment belief in a positive sum social order, in which human beings who are both competitive and cooperative creatures can prosper without making others poor. Hence, the Enlightenment belief in and Trump's disbelief in free trade. Postmodernism is the ill-named revival of a pre-modern mentality. The social order as constant conflict, unleavened by trust and constrained only by the authoritarianism of the dominant group. In The Darkening Mind, written for American purpose, Garfunkel says that the further we look left or right, we see the erosion of the Enlightenment aspiration of institutionalizing positive sum relationships. This aspiration, which gives dignity to modern politics, undergirds the case for capitalism, a spontaneous consensual order of freely cooperating individuals. In zero-sum thinking, Garfinkel says, the consent of the governed is an empty piety because its legitimacy attaches to whichever group imposes dominance. And as American culture and politics increasingly reveal, in the zero-sum mentality, no neutral space can exist in which is, by definition, a totally conflictional environment. Postmodernism's politics is, as Garfinkel says, an agglomeration of reheated Marxism, only conflict is real and it is ubiquitous, and crypto-theology, including secularized original sin of the nation, see the New York Times 1619 Project, and Christian martyrology recycled in competitive claims of group victimhood. Increasingly, mass market entertainment features cartoonish characters with teenage vocabularies because, as Garfinkel says, plots need to be simple. For minds seeped in zero-sum, non-thinking, simple-minded us-versus-them stories, they work better than positive-sum, more nuanced portrayals of human relationships. And Garfinkel plausibly argues, the cacophony of zero-sum shouting between right and left extremes, amplified by clickbait-oriented commercial media, spreads zero-sum thinking nationwide. As Trump's four-year snarl ends, recognize that the least intellectual president had a mentality, such as the seepage of intellectual fashions into empty receptacles, akin to that which has closed the academic mind. To people whose social theories and politics are infused with postmodernism, Trump has been like God, not because of his perfect goodness and infinite mercy, but because he is the explanation of everything, actually, postmodernists are part of the explanation of him. That was a very convoluted column by George Will. And this next opinion column is written by someone local, Ray Elliott. He's an author and a former high school teacher, and he lives in rural Urbana. And this is from the section called Voices. When Nero ruled Rome, life got complicated. Roman Emperor Nero, named Lucius Dominatus Armenobarbus, at birth, ruled almost 2,000 years ago. He was born on December 15, 37 AD, not long after Pontius Pilate had Jesus crucified between two thieves. I recall hearing that while Rome was burning, Nero was playing the fiddle. That's fake news, maybe. So I sought the truth. According to the ancient biographer Suetonius, Nero was the son of the first emperor's only daughter, and his ancestors were not what you would call hospitable folks. His grandfather enjoyed violent gladiator games. His father was irascible and brutal. His father, Dominatus, had apparently been involved in a political scandal and died in 40 AD when Nero was 3. Before that, his mother, Agrippina, had her own scandal and was suspected of adultery with her brother-in-law. Quite a group running things back then, replete with banishments, power grabs, and plots to take control, even an assassination. Just the kind of environment for someone to seize control. His great-uncle Claudius took Nero's mother for his fourth wife and added Claudius to his name to mark the adoption. And so he became Nero Claudius Caesar Drusus Germanicus and entered public life as an adult at 14 years old. While there were differing accounts about how Claudius died in 54 AD, most think Agrippina helped to make sure her son would become emperor. So, with a little manipulation, Nero rose to power. All reports from ancient writers say that Nero was extravagant in his construction projects and spending the country's funds and left the provinces ruined. But historians today take a different view, believing he was really interested in making things better with public works projects and charity, which took lots of cash and seems likely for someone leading his country to make it great. Still, Nero's policies were deemed well-meant but incompetent notions, like a failed initiative to abolish taxes in an effort to help the people. Just 16 when he became emperor in 54 AD, Nero had no experience in governing. His tutor, Seneca, is said to have written his first speech before the Senate, and it's been reported that his mother meant to rule through her son. While she was doing that, they say she got even with her political rivals, murdering 3 of them. How's that for taking care of business? Nero followed in her footsteps by getting rid of people who didn't share his beliefs. It was also said to be having an affair with a slave girl, and he poisoned his half-brother Britannicus because his mother sided with him when she saw Nero was following his own mind. That got her exiled. Later, Nero had his mother killed, possibly because of her disapproval of his affair with Poppaea Sabina while she was still married. The modern scholar Miriam Griffiths suggests things really went downhill after that, saying, Nero lost all sense of right and wrong and listened to flattery with total credulity. Prior to this, his relationship with the Senate had been relatively good, but scholar Jurgen Mallets writes, Nero abandoned the restraint he had previously shown because he believed a course supporting the Senate promised to be less and less profitable. He divorced another of his wives, Octavia, on grounds of infertility, banished her, and when there were public protesters, accused her of adultery and executed her. He married again in 64 AD, the same year the Great Fire of Rome erupted. That was the night of July 18th and 19th when many mansions, residences, and temples burned. The fire lasted a week, destroying 3 of 14 districts and severely damaging 7 more. Differing accounts of the cause have described it as an accident, a plot by Nero, or simply unsure. Some said a plot arose from Nero's dislike of the ancient construction and desire to build his own lush palace and a 30-meter-tall statue of himself, the Colossus of Nero. So he accused the Christians of starting the fire and had many arrested and brutally executed by being thrown to the beasts, crucified, or burned alive. More than 2,000 years later, scholars and historians continue to research and argue over whether Nero started the fire, then sang and played the fiddle while Rome burned. But he ruled his kingdom for several years and did pretty much what he wanted. And I need to stop. I'll finish this article in the next half hour because it is interesting, especially if you're a history buff. This is Kathy saying thanks for listening and stay tuned.